All right, Revelation chapter 15, and we're ready to look at verses 5 through 8. Revelation 15, verses 5 through 8. I know I'm not leaving let you get settled in your seat, Tom, there, but can you find that?
Revelation 15?
5 to 8.
And after that I looked, and behold, the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven was opened. And the seven angels came out of the temple, having seven plagues, clothed in pure and white linen, and having their breasts girded with golden girdles. And one of the four beasts gave unto the seven angels seven golden vials, full of the wrath of God, who liveth forever and ever. And the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from his power, and no man was able to enter into the temple till the seven plagues of the seven angels were fulfilled.
All right, so we read here about this opening of the tabernacle, or the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven. All right, so here's obviously using some terminology that goes back to the Old Testament. And of course, in the Old Testament, there was, well, first the tabernacle itself, and then you had the temple that was later built. What happened to the original tabernacle that had been located in Shiloh through the period of the Judges? And we know it was destroyed, and the Lord forsook it because of the people turning away from him, and it certainly seems to fit the time of 1 Samuel chapter 4 when Hophni and Phinehas, those two wicked sons of Eli, the high priest, brought the Ark of the Covenant into the camp of Israel to try to get a victory over the Philistines. Their faith being, they said, that ark was going to save them, not God. God had forsaken them because they had turned away from him. So rather than fixing their problem and repenting and turning back to God, they thought bringing that object into the camp was going to somehow magically give them a victory over the Philistines. And of course it did not. And the Philistines took the Ark of the Covenant. That all of that is going to relate to at least... It fits in with some of what he's describing here, as there's an association with the opening of this temple of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven with the pouring out of these seven last plagues filled with the wrath of God. He's taking terms from the Old Testament that relate to that. All right, well, God pouring out his wrath. Is there anything from the Old Testament that would go along with that or fit that? Well, as we mentioned, there was a tabernacle, and it ended up being destroyed, but the a temple was built, of course, under Solomon. We're studying that on Sunday mornings right now. But the tabernacle, the organization of the tabernacle, the way it was, the design of it in its parts and what was in what went where and for what purpose, all of that God gave by his commandments also was included in the temple when it was built. And so you had two main sections of the tabernacle or the temple. And what was it that divided or separated those two sections? Well, there was a curtain or a veil. So what was on either side of that? Well, it separated between what was known as the holy place in the temple, which that term refers to it being sacred or set apart for God. So could just anyone go into the holy place in the temple or the tabernacle? No. Who could go in there? only the priests. And who were the priests? Those were of the tribe of Levi, but not even could any Levite go into the temple, into the building, or the tabernacle. No, not every Levite could, only the priests. And I know we've studied this out before, but you had the tribe of Levi. Well, you have all of Israel with the 12 tribes. But of the 12 tribes of Israel, only the tribe of Levi could do certain things. You had all the families of Levi that were involved in the service of the Lord. But of the families of Levi, you had the descendants, or the sons of Aaron. And these were the priests. So only the sons of Aaron. So all priests were Levites, but not all Levites were priests. Does that make sense? So every priest was a descendant from Aaron, who was a Levite. But of course, there were lots of other families of the tribe of Levi than Aaron's. And so those people could not be serve in the position of priests. Well, do you remember a Levite that objected to that back early in this time when God gave that commandment? God was the one that ordained that. Well, who objected to that? You remember in Numbers chapter 16, a man named Korah? He was a Levite, but he was not Aaron's son. And he got jealous and he accused, of course, Moses was a Levite. He was the brother of Aaron. But Moses had the position of being the judge of Israel. So he was the top leader. And then you have his brother Aaron, who is the high priest. And so this Korah objected to that and said they were taking this on too much to themselves. So he was accusing them of hogging all the power. Of course, they hadn't taken that on themselves at all. It was given to them by God. And so he was really complaining or murmuring against God. And go back and read. We don't have time right now. But in Numbers 16, when he raised that rebellion, he had several that followed him in that. God dealt with it. How? He made the earth open up and swallowed them and closed up on them. So a chasm opened up in the earth and they went in it and it closed over them. Bye-bye, Korah. But God made he obviously did something very unusual there to make a statement. And in the next chapter in Exodus, number 17, then God did something else to let it be known that only the sons of Aaron were authorized by him to be priests. He got all the tribes to make a rod. And then Aaron's name was put on that for Levi. And what did God make that rod of Aaron do? It budded. And it budded. What did it bud? Almonds. You remember that? That's in number 17. And that was one of the objects that got put into the Ark of the Covenant. There were only a few things. You remember what went in the Ark of the Covenant? Because this pertains to all this, what we're reading about. You might think I'm off on some wild tangent. And I know I do that from time to time, but that's not what I'm doing right now. This actually does relate very much to what we're studying here in Revelation 15. When God made Aaron's rod to bud, that was his testimony. I'm only authorizing Aaron's sons to be my priests. And so they were the only ones that were allowed to go into the holy place. Nobody else, not even the other Levites. And they're examples of many examples of when people rebelled against that arrangement that God made against his authority, and then paid for it. and God made demonstrations and examples of them for that, for us to remember. Korah being one of them. And Korah is brought up in the New Testament a couple of different times. 2 Peter 2, Book of Jude. So we're supposed to remember what he did. He rebelled against the authority arrangement of God. A lot of people are doing that today, aren't they? And they don't know whose steps they're walking in. They're following Korah and don't know it. But God did something with Korah so we would know not to do that. Alright, so only the priest could go in there. Then they had the veil, and behind that veil was the most holy place. And that's where the Ark of the Covenant was. Now, I was in the process of asking a moment ago, what was inside the Ark of the Covenant? There were a few objects. I named one for you. That rod of Aaron that budded and produced almonds. God told him to put that in there. There were three objects that went in there, and all of them had very important connotations to it with lessons. Certainly that rod of Aaron, the authority of God, and who could go into that most holy place in the temple where the Ark of the Covenant was. And so there, that rod that God made to bud. I mean, you can't take a stick, go pick up a stick somewhere. It's not going to bud. It's not going to grow something. That was a miracle. But God did that to show that he authorized only Aaron's sons to be his priests. And they were the only ones that could go into the temple or the tabernacle at that time. The other two objects that were in there, what was the first thing that was put in there? Big obvious one. What's that?
The tablets.
Yes, with the Ten Commandments. So the Ten Commandments went in there. I think we can all understand why that was in there. I mean, you talk about the symbol of the authority of God and the law that he gave to that nation. Boom. I mean, that's put right in the Ark of the Covenant. All right, what was the second thing that went in there? I told you the third. What was the second? When God made the manna to fall, and then he told them to put a pot with that manna inside the Ark of the Covenant. So you had the Ten Commandments on those tables of stone. You had a pot with the manna in it. I mean, that was obviously going, what God did to provide for and sustain the Israelites through the wilderness and all that time. He wanted them to remember that. And then, of course, that rod of Aaron that budded. So those were objects that God had them place in the Ark of the Covenant. And they all were very significant in their own way. You could preach a sermon out of that, couldn't you? but anyway, I get ideas. And you can feel free to borrow that one too. That sounds like that would work. You can learn a lot just studying that. But then in the most holy place, where who could go in there? Only the high priest, and how often? Once a year, on the Day of Atonement, and that was it. There were very particular designations for the tabernacle and the temple, who could go in it and at what time. Now, you may remember there was a Azariah, also known as Uzziah. He was one of the kings of Judah. And he prospered greatly. He followed the Lord for many years and prospered for it. God blessed him and made his kingdom strong. Well, he got full of himself then. He got puffed up and lifted up in pride. And then he decided he was above the law. That he was so big that he could do whatever he wanted. And so he just decided nobody could tell him he couldn't go in the temple. He just went in there himself. Of course, he was from the tribe of Judah. He was not a priest, was not authorized to be one. He hadn't remembered that lesson, had he? And then what happened to him when he went in there? God turned him leprous. And then that was it for him. He couldn't rule as king anymore. He was separated into a leper's house by himself, and his son then became king. So we have a lot of examples there from the Old Testament associated with the temple and the tabernacle and the authority of God and that Ark of the Covenant itself. Just mentioning several examples when people didn't submit to the authority of God, and when it pertained to things involving the tabernacle or the temple, didn't go well for the ones who rebelled, did it? Like Korah, like King Uzziah. So that's what some of these things keep in mind, because when he's talking about the opening up of this temple of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven, I mean, it's got its roots in all of that. And that testimony, what was the testimony, of course, were the tables of stone in the ark, which was called the Ark of the Testimony. That was one of the names. It was called the Ark of the Covenant. What's the covenant? The testimony. God's covenant with Israel. So that language there goes along with that. Of course, the Ark of the Testimony was in the most holy place in the temple. Now, what happened when it was opened? Now, the fact that God had certain things to put in there, that mean that everybody in Israel could go in and just take a look to be reminded? No, that's not what God's... In fact, God told them they weren't... Nobody was allowed to touch that ark. They couldn't look in it. They couldn't touch it. Now, who could carry it? There were... was the Kohathites, right? That family of the Levites. Only those... There was a designated family of the Levites that could carry it in a certain manner with the staves that went through the rings on that ark. When they didn't do that right, what happened? Well, when David was having the ark moved and then they put it on a cart, instead of having the Levites who were designated to do that work to do it God's way, when they put it on a cart carried by oxen, which God, that didn't come from God. That was not God's, he never brought that up. That was man's idea. And what happened? Well, the oxen stumbled, the cart wobbled, and there was a Levite named Uzzah who was on the cart there. And he puts his hand and catches the ark to steady it. He didn't want it to fall. We might think, well, that was a good thing for Uzzah to do. Maybe we're thinking that. But that's picking it up too late in the narrative. You got to go back before. What's it doing on a cart in the first place? See, what actually happens, that's a consequence of where the wrong decision was made far before that. So it's the wrong place to examine that situation is at the point where the oxen stumble and Uzzah puts his hand to touch the ark. Because that we might feel sympathetic for Uzzah in a sense, but when we go back before that, I mean, he should never have been where he was. It should have never been in that circumstance. That's why it went bad. When we don't do things God's way, it doesn't go well. I mean, that's a big, big lesson, isn't it? If we try to do things our own way instead of God's way, how does it work out? I mean, we make a mess of things. When we do it our way and we ignore God's way, whatever it is in our lives, whether it's talking about our families or what we do as part of the church or the way we conduct ourselves in anything, if we come up with our own way of doing things and we ignore God's way, how's it going to go? We'll make a mess of it. And God's not going to bless it to bear fruit and turn out for something good when it's not done his way. And that was an example of that. So Uzzah touched the ark. And what happened? I mean, he was killed. He was killed instantly. That was... So then they parked it, and then David went to look into the matter and figured out where they went wrong, and he rebuked the Levites for not having done it God's way. And so then the next time they reattempted it, doing it the right way, the Lord's way, and it says God helped them, and everything went very smoothly and well, as it does. That doesn't mean it's going to be... Everything's going to be easy when we do it God's way, but it will turn out right. If we persist with that, it's going to turn out right. So there's just a lot of things that go back to events pertaining to the Ark of the Covenant, the Temple and the Tabernacle, all relating to the authority of God. And every single time that we can think of somebody that didn't do things the Lord's way, the punishment was severe. I mean, it was fatal to not respect the authority of God and all of that. Okay, in the book of 1 Samuel in chapter 6, and I wish, and I do apologize for making reference to a bunch of these events and things rather than taking the time to actually read through all of those texts, trying to give you the chapters and things to go and look at, but we just, for time's sake, if we were to try to attempt to read the text and all these things that I've mentioned, these examples, we would be, we wouldn't get through even that. But anyway, those are all good things for us to go back and look at in more detail on our own. But anyway, in 1 Samuel chapter 6, this is another chapter. I wish we had time to read the whole thing, and even going back a couple of chapters before that, we were just talking about these, what was going on here, the roots of what was going on in chapter 6, go back to chapter 4 and even before that. With Hophni and Phinehas, Eli was the high priest in that time. This is when Samuel the prophet was very young, when God first spoke to him as a prophet. In fact, the first prophecy that God gave through Samuel was of the destruction of the house of Eli, because Eli's son, now Eli, there's not a single scripture that ever impugns Eli's character or speaks of any immoral behavior on his part. The criticism of Eli that God gave was that he did not stop his sons from doing what they were doing when they were fully wicked. They were immoral. They committed fornication with women at the door of the tabernacle. They took the sacrifices and made the people despise the sacrifices because they would take of the fat which God did not permit to be eaten, and then they would eat that. So they corrupted the sacrifices. They corrupted the tabernacle. So there's another example. They rebelled against God's authority, and then God said He was going to put an end to the house of Eli. Now He worked that over a century to bring all the way to Solomon's time, and so it took about 100 years for God to fulfill all of that prophecy for the house of Eli to. He said no one would live to be old in the house of Eli after that. So there were many tragedies that occurred in David's time when he was still young, while Saul was king. You remember Doeg the Edomite killed 80 of the priests there in Nob. Well, those were all of the house of Eli still. That was part of that destruction. I mean, they didn't do anything to deserve that from what we're told there, but that was wickedness by Doeg and Saul, but it still was part of the fulfillment of what God had said about against the house of Eli. But what God also said was that the sign that all of that would come to pass was going to be that Hophni and Phinehas were both going to die together one day. And that happened in 1 Samuel 4 when they brought the Ark of the Covenant into the camp to try to get a victory over the Philistines. They had already lost one battle against them because of their wickedness. God was punishing them by bringing the Philistines against them. So the only solution to that problem was to repent. But rather than that, they said, well, let's bring the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark will give us a victory over the Philistines. Well, God didn't let that happen. And so a second battle was fought, and they lost in a big way. And Hophni and Phinehas got killed. So they lost a battle. The two sons of the high priest died, and then the Philistines took the Ark of the Covenant. And it certainly fits the timeline from the other things that were told in other passages, that the tabernacle in Shiloh would have most likely have been destroyed during that time. But at any rate, afterwards, the Philistines took the Ark of the Covenant to their own land, put it in the house of Dagon, a idol of theirs, and that's in 1 Samuel chapter 5. And then the idol broke, And so God, and then plagued the city. And so then they moved it. It went to three different cities of the Philistines, and they were all plagued in every one of them. And so they decided, let's get this thing out of here. And so they put it on a, they put it on a cart with two milk cows. Now, under normal circumstances, two milk cows, if they have babies, they're going to go where they're, they're going to go where their babies are. But those two ignored that and went straight for Israel with the ark on the cart. So God obviously made that happen. And that was in 1 Samuel chapter 6 in verse 15. If we could read that, 1 Samuel 6 and verse 15, we'll see where that ark finally arrived in Israel. Let's see, Brother Quentin, can you read verse 15? And then 19 through 21.
And the Levites took down the ark of the Lord and called for those with it, where the jewels of gold were, and put them on a gray stone. And then the Beth-Shemesh offered burnt offerings and sacrifices the same day to the Lord. Verse 19?
Yeah, 19 through 21.
And he smote the men of Beth-Shemesh because they had looked into the ark of the Lord. And even these smote up people, 50,000, 80 men. The people lamented because the Lord had smitten many of the people with great slaughter. And the men of Beth-Shemesh said, "Who is able to stand before this holy Lord God? And to whom shall he go up from us?" They sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kirjath-Jearim, saying, "The Philistines brought again the ark of the Lord, come ye down and
fetch
it up to you."
Well, they had a reaction there in Beth-Shemesh like the Philistines had to get the ark out of there. But actually, I mean, the ark itself, was that the problem? Wasn't the presence? That's what they were doing with it. So, how many died in Beth-Shemesh? Yeah. So they looked in there. God said, don't do it. They weren't allowed to look in it or touch it. So we talk about this 50,000. We talk about Uzzah, Hophni, Phinehas, Uzziah, Korah. I mean, the list goes on and on. The people who violated God's commandments and showed no respect to his authority in things pertaining to the tabernacle and the temple, and particularly the Ark of the Covenant. What ended up happening? Does it fit then when he's using that language in Revelation 15 with the opening of, and of course here's the ultimate tabernacle of people in heaven, as Jesus went into the most holy place of all with his own blood as an offering, being in heaven itself. So we have that image that's in Hebrews. But in heaven itself is associated as being the most holy place. So, I mean, the tabernacle, the physical one, it was a shadow of the church. But then there's also in its parts with the most holy place, there's even a shadow of heaven in that. And with what Christ did, the things that the priests and the Levites, or the priests and the high priest did in the Old Testament with the tabernacle and temple, were shadows of what, by what they couldn't do. It was a shadow of what Christ would do when he came and did with one offering of himself for all, forever. So there's this tabernacle in heaven that's open, that tabernacle of the testimony, and it's opened there, and then the outpouring of God's wrath comes. So it's a fitting, reviewed several of those examples from the Old Testament to show how he's using language that have its echoes there, just like he does throughout the book of Revelation, when he says things and they have their roots in the Old Testament. Understanding the reference helps to understand the point that he's making in Revelation. So when we know what happened in the Old Testament and those matters regarding the ark, and the tabernacle and temple, well, that makes sense. You know, when he's describing this opening up and then the outpouring of the wrath of God, Because if you're on the wrong side of God's authority and you're not submitting to it, what happens? That's what those examples from the Old Testament are. But now here's the real pouring out. This is the judgment of all the wicked that's coming. So it's going to be severe. And so then in verse 6, those seven angels came out of the temple with these seven plagues. They were clothed in pure white and white linen, and they had golden girdles upon their breast. And then one of the four beasts gave those seven angels seven golden vials that were full of the wrath of God, the God who lives forever and ever. And at that moment in verse 8, what happens with the temple there in heaven? This also has roots into the Old Testament. Okay, when the original tabernacle was constructed, what happened? Well, they set up the tabernacle in Exodus chapter 40, the last chapter of the book of Exodus. And it talks about, well, actually, let's go ahead and read 33 through 35 here in Exodus chapter 40. Let's see. Brother Stephen, could you read that? Exodus chapter 40, verses 33 through 35.
He reared up the court round about the tabernacle and the altar, and set up the hanging of the court gate. So Moses finished the work. Then a cloud covered the tent of the congregation, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter into the tent of the congregation because the cloud rolled thereon, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle.
Okay, so when the tabernacle was completed, what was the event that occurred at that moment? Well, he gives a description there of a cloud covering the tent and then the glory of the Lord filling that. And Moses couldn't even enter into the tabernacle at that time as the cloud was upon it and the glory of the Lord was filled that tabernacle then. Same thing happened. I mean, you can read in 1 Kings 8 or 2 Chronicles 6. That contains the description. We should be getting there fairly, not too terribly long from now, Lord willing, in our study of those books on Sunday morning. So we should be arriving there, which might give us an opportunity to remind ourselves of what we're doing right now tonight, what we're looking at in Revelation. But when the temple was completed, same thing happened. And God's glory filled it. That happened with the tabernacle when it was completed, and then the temple with that. So then we have really identical language then in the book of Revelation with what happened there in heaven at this time when he's going to pour out his wrath, his judgment on the wicked, as the temple is filled with smoke from the glory of God. And so nobody could enter into the temple. Just like Moses was not able to enter into the tabernacle because of it. But now he says nobody was going to be able to enter into that temple in heaven until the seven plagues of the seven angels were fulfilled. So it's very interesting just to see how the language, the events of many of those things in the Old Testament, how he takes from that and will use the same language here in Revelation. But making my point here. And all of this is in preparation for the pouring out of these seven vials with the seven plagues containing the wrath of God. Just reading that, all that, here we have, I know it's a short chapter, 8 verses long, but that chapter of 8 verses is going through all of this to set the stage or to prepare for what's coming and what's going to be poured out in chapter 16. Well, do you really even have to read a word of chapter 16, what comes next, just based in what was leading up to that in chapter 15 and what we know about those references from the Old Testament and what happened to the ones who rebelled against the authority of God and wouldn't submit to Him then. I mean, what's going to happen? I mean, do you have to even read the details of the outpouring to know this isn't going to be good? I mean, that should be very obvious just from the way he's setting it up. This is going to be something that's going to be truly awful for the ones who are on the receiving end of that. But as we're getting ready to read some of those details now in chapter 16, it doesn't need to be that way. There's no reason for... No one has to be on the receiving end of that. Sadly, the majority will, but no one has to. How much has God done to provide the way for every single soul that He's made to avoid this? I mean, to the point of giving up His own Son so that we would not have to partake of that, which is something that should remind us of what we all need to be thankful for. I mean, really, without Christ, all we'd be reading here is about what's inevitable for all of us, right? I mean, without Him, I mean, how would we have a way of reconciliation to God? How would we have a way of forgiveness of sins? How would we have a way then to footsteps to follow in to be able to overcome sin and to be able to partake of the divine nature and be what God wants us to be? How can we have any of that without Christ? And then what would be in store for us all? But that's not the way it should be. I mean, who can say God hasn't done enough to save the souls of men that He's made? Has He done enough? I mean, He's gone so far beyond, I mean, in what He's done. I mean, who would... And did He have to do that? I mean, we're the ones that sinned against Him. We're the ones that did wrong. But God, He loves us that much, and that we should be reminded of that from this, that God's made a way of escape from that. But at the same time, does that mean... that God is going to refuse to punish the ones who don't repent, the ones who refuse Him? Is He going to just give everybody a pass? No. I mean, what were all those events in the Old Testament for? A lot of people look at it and say, well, that's to show us how God has grown or changed. He's not like that anymore. That's really a wicked point of view. Because it's accusatory against God. But God hasn't changed. He said that in Malachi 4:6. I am Jehovah, I change not. He hasn't changed. Romans 11:22 says, behold the goodness and the severity of God. Well, you can behold that in the Old Testament. You can behold it in the New Testament. Did He only strike people dead in the Old Testament? Ask Ananias and Sapphira in Acts 5. I know we can't, but... were they able to speak? What would they say? Well, you can read it. What happened in Acts 5? Struck dead, both of them. It's not... When we're talking about Uzzah or Hophni, Phinehas, or any of those other people, that wasn't something that only... God only did stuff like that in the Old Testament. Well, He's going to pour out... He's going to give the ultimate judgment, pouring out of His wrath on Judgment Day against all of those who do not know Him and have not obeyed the gospel of Christ. That's the point of 2 Thessalonians 1:7 through 9. Jesus is going to come in flaming fire, taking vengeance on those who know not God and obey not the gospel of Christ. That's going to happen. But we have so many opportunities in this life to be able to escape that judgment and that wrath. But let's go over to the book of Hebrews for a moment, as it fits into this, before we launch into chapter 16. The beginning of the book of Hebrews draws a contrast between the words that God inspired through the messengers of the Old Testament, those prophets, and the chief messenger of the New Covenant, that being His own Son. But let's read the first two verses of the book of Hebrews, Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. Let's see. You already read for us, didn't you, Brother Glenn? Oh, you haven't? All right. I was warned, but you ready?
Ready.
All right, Hebrews 1, 1 and 2.
God, who at sundry times and endowed with man, spake in time past unto the fathers by the prophets, hath in these last days spoken unto us by his Son, whom he hath appointed heir of all things, by whom also he made the world.
Okay, so did God inspire those prophets of the Old Testament? He did. That was all his word. But what has he done in these last days? I mean, there was different ways that he revealed his word in the Old Testament. It was still his word. Did it count? Sure did. But what about now? His own son. The one that he has made the appointed heir of all things. The one by whom also he made the worlds. Is there any weight to that? That now he is... You remember the parable that Jesus gave of the Lord of the vineyard. And he Matthew 21. But he spoke about that Lord of the vineyard sent his husbandmen into the vineyard to gather the fruits. And the ones who were there of his servants, what did they do with the ones that he sent? They killed them. And so then, you know, one by one. And so then finally he sent his son and said, they'll reverence my son. And they said, look, here's the heir. We'll kill him and seize the vineyard for our inheritance. And they killed his son. And then he asked them, what will the Lord of that vineyard do to those wicked servants or the wicked husbandmen? And they gave the answer, but then Jesus made the point of it, and they understood that he was speaking about them. Well, who were those servants that he sent first? I mean, those were the prophets. And what did the Jews do to their prophets so many times? They killed them. But then he sent his own son. What did he do? And this is the essence of Stephen's sermon in Acts 7 that got him stoned. So they did it again. But with Jesus, then they killed him, his God's own son. But, I mean, the difference was also given in that parable. I mean, he had all those prophets that he sent, but then who was the most special of all? But the very Son of God. And that's who he sent, into the world and gave the everlasting covenant through. Now he's going to build on that. There are several verses we got through the end of chapter 1. But really, from the point that he starts off with in those first two verses of Hebrews 1, he builds on that with a therefore in verse 1 of chapter 2. So if God now in these last days has spoken to us by his Son, whom he's appointed heir of all things, and by whom also he made the worlds, what's the point of that? Therefore, what? Well, that's chapter 2, 1 through 4, Brother Aaron. Hebrews 2, 1 to 4. Therefore, since God has spoken to us in these last days by his Son, what's the point? What should we do? Ought to give the more earnest heed to the things which we've heard, lest any time that we should let them slip. Should we be equally attentive to what Christ, God's Son, has spoken in the New Testament to what God spoke to the prophets in the Old Testament? Less attentive or more attentive? We ought to give the more earnest heed. Since it's God's own Son, we should be even more attentive to what he has said. And then he makes a point. Well, did that mean that there was a lack of authority in what God said in the Old Testament, since it wasn't spoken directly through his son? No. What happened with every transgression and disobedience under that law? We've just been talking about that. And that's why we're looking at this now, because this is much of the point of Revelation 15 and on into 16. He's going back to, he uses some imagery there from the Old Testament that is associated with many of these just recompenses of reward against these ones who sinned against God. But if that happened to them, what's going to happen if we ignore what he said to his son? If 50,000 people died because they looked into the Ark of the Covenant back then, what's going to happen to those who don't listen to God's own son now? Well, that's what we're about to find out in Revelation 16. You think 50,000 people dying there in Beth Shemesh in 1 Samuel chapter 6 was bad? We're about to read about the outpouring of the thumos of God on all the wicked here in Revelation 16. Well, we already got a glimpse of it at the end of chapter 14 when he spoke of that great winepress of the wrath of God that was a 200-mile river of blood that was, 6 feet high or more. I mean, that's graphic, folks. I mean, it really is. So we're going to get more of that in Revelation 16 as we see what God how he describes the pouring out of his wrath. I mean, the point being, none of us wants any part of that. It's going to be severe for those who have rejected the Son of God. And that's much of the point here. All right, so we don't want to forget that, because, I mean, when we start reading the details of that, we don't want to forget the overall point to it. That is, here's what happens when we don't listen to the Lord and don't follow Christ. And then alongside of that, we don't have to end up receiving this. We can follow Christ and escape that. In fact, have the reward that he was describing at the beginning of chapter 15 to those who overcome, then be there standing on that sea of glass right there before the throne of God, singing that new song of Moses and the Lamb. Those are the two. We have the contrast, the great contrast of what kind of eternity we can have, where we'll spend it. And we certainly want to be there among those in the first part of Revelation 15, not what we're going to be reading about here in Revelation 16. All right. Well, let's go ahead and at least get our feet wet a little bit looking into chapter 16, recognizing, of course, that we're not going to get to read all of this tonight, but let's go ahead and see the beginning of this with the pouring out of these seven vials. Let's look at verses 1 and 2 that will cover the pouring out of the first vial of these seven. All right, Revelation 16, verses 1 and 2. Let's see, Brother Dave.
And I heard a great voice out of the temple saying to the seven angels, "Go your ways and pour out the vials of the wrath of God upon the earth." And the first wind poured out his vial upon the earth, and there fell a noisome and grievous sore upon the men which had the mark of the beast, and upon them which worshipped his image.
Okay. Now some of this will remind us of the loosing of the seventh seal, going back to Revelation chapter 8, when those first four of the, there was the seventh seal that was loosed, and it had seven parts from those seven angels, and four of them we read about in Revelation 8, and then you have the other three with the three woes. And when we read that part, and that was a while ago, we saw that a lot of the description of those things that God was, those plagues he was bringing upon those who were wicked at that point in the book, they sounded a lot like, and they used language and symbols that many of them from the plague, the 10 plagues that God brought upon the Egyptians. We'll see some of that again here. But first in the verse 1, John hears a great voice out of the temple. Well, where's this temple again? In verse 5 of chapter 15, it's in heaven. I mean, who? So where is, what's the significance of this, that John hears a great voice from the temple saying to those seven angels for them to go their ways and pour out those vials of the wrath of God upon the earth? Well, this tells us the source. I mean, it's reminding us of the source of all of this. This is from God. The God of heaven himself is speaking out of his temple, commanding these angels to do this. So they are his messengers to carry out his will and his commandments with what to do with these plagues. It also reminds us of the role that angels have. I mean, what are angels? I mean, what does the word mean?
Messenger.
It means messenger. And God used, you can read in the Old Testament and the New Testament, God would use his angels as his messengers. Now, sometimes they would carry a message of his word to his righteous ones. Sometimes there were blessings that they were, blessings from God that they were sent to convey or promise as God's word. But there were other times that they were sent to bring about God's punishment, like the one that meted out his judgment when after David numbered the people. And that was a great plague. And there are other examples of that. So the point is, when God would do a work, I mean, how often do we read where he would use his angels to carry out his work, whatever that work was? I mean, that was a pattern that God operated by, that we read. Did God stop doing that? Is there any scripture that that in any way hints that God was going to just suddenly put all his angels into retirement and that they would no longer be used as his messengers? I mean, they're not directly speaking to men today, but as far as God using them to carry out his will and do whatever he's doing and running the universe, he's always used them, and he still is. I mean, that to think otherwise is not very wise. At any rate, as we see an example of that here, but God sending these angels out to carry out his will and to pour out his wrath upon the earth. And so the first one that goes and pours out his vial on the earth, and what was the result? A noisome and grievous sore. And who did that fall upon? I mean, at this point in Revelation, you got two categories of people. And this goes back to chapter 13. You got one category of people that is the world as a whole, and they all had the mark of that beast and worshiped his image. The ones who didn't were the ones who were persecuted at the end of chapter 13. They were the ones that have God's mark in their foreheads at the beginning of chapter 14. Well, they're the ones that are spared from the wrath of God, going back to chapter 7. So this is very specific as far as whom God's wrath. This is not just some general bad thing that's going to happen and affect everybody. This is something specifically poured out by God upon the wicked. These wicked ones being the ones who had the mark of the beast and upon those who worshiped his image. You can't read that verse if you've forgotten all about chapter 13. That's not going to make a lot of sense to what he says there in verse 2. So it's good to go back and remind ourselves of that. These were the ones who were They were following the dragon, Satan. He was behind that beast in its image. So that was what he was using them to do, to entice men to worship and follow this wickedness, not God. What's going to happen to them? Anyone who follows the devil's ways and rebels against God's are going to pay for it. They're going to be punished for that. There's going to be eternal punishment for it. Now, he's going to eventually get to, as we go on into chapter 19 and 20, the one who's behind it all, himself, what's going to happen to him? The dragon's going down. I mean, he's going to be put in that lake of fire. That's who he made it for. So that it's not like he's orchestrating all this and then he's going to escape himself. I mean, he's going to have the worst judgment of all. But at any rate, the devil himself and all those who follow him are going to end up being subject to the wrath of God. All right, well, we're even a minute past, so we'll stop there for tonight. And Lord willing, we'll pick it up in Revelation 16:3. We'll have a little bit more to say about verse 2, Lord willing.